for a similar-sized station elsewhere that was also facing a cross-ownership situation. They were concerned that the Washington Post Company had too much dominance in Washington, D.C., right under the eyes of Congress, and that a decision against cross-ownership would come at a moment when we were in the midst of a license renewal and therefore not in a position to try for a station swap at that time. Warren and I made the rounds of all the possible comparable stations in Los Angeles, Dallas, Houston, Atlanta, Detroit. Only Peter Clark, head of the Detroit News Company, which had both a newspaper and a television station in a depressed area, was interested in talking. Detroit was nearly the same size market as Washington. At the time, we were the 8th largest broadcast market in the country, and Detroit was the 7th. The major difference was that our market was growing and theirs was stagnant. However, in some ways, Detroit was a better television town than a newspaper town, so there was some hope of ending up in a profitable situation. The decision of whether to trade WTOP for WWJ in Detroit, later renamed WDIV, was mine, and I was enough worried about the political climate and the weakness of our newspaper competition in Washington that I decided in favor of it. Warren and I together initially negotiated with Peter in Detroit. He wanted $6 million cash plus WTOP because his station was bigger and more profitable than ours. We said that was too much. Peter came to see me in Washington, and I asked Warren to be there, but he said I could and should do it on my own, and we finally settled for $2 million. The deal was done, the first time I had negotiated by myself. But still, I was not very happy. We were giving up our oldest station, one with connections back to Phil and my father, one which I knew and loved, and which we'd built up to number one in the market, for Detroit, a strange town, unlike any I had known. When the actual changeover came, people at WTOP were so devoted to Jim Snyder, our news director who was going to Detroit for us, that the anchors burst into tears when they signed off for the last time under our ownership. The situation in Detroit was worse than my worst fears. We had traded a top-flight station in a dynamic market for a mediocre station in a market that was mired in a recession. On top of that, the station was an NBC affiliate, and NBC at that time was a network in trouble. We had our usual new-in-the-market problems. We wanted to run a better station, but resistance to change was endemic, and Detroiters were used to having their news delivered in a certain way, no matter how bad it may have been. Again, as in Trenton, we were painted as the out-of-towners. Any time we made a mistake or tried something new, critics at the other stations or at the newspapers leapt on us. It was so bad that Jim Snyder had a serious heart attack and had to leave. I suffered acutely at having decided to make the trade, particularly after the Supreme Court handed down its decision, grandfathering those companies who already had stations in cross-ownership towns. Little by little, the Detroit station improved and became very successful, but that didn't happen before I had spent an inordinate amount of time blaming myself. As part of the larger plan to acquire several smaller newspapers which never materialized, in 1978 we also bought the Everett Herald, a small paper located in a city north of Seattle, Washington. As with the Trenton Times, the Herald was acquired after poor appraisal. We paid a monopoly price for a paper that was in a somewhat competitive situation with Seattle, and then proceeded not to run it well until recently, when it has been vastly improved. We also participated with Dow Jones in a startup newsprint mill at Bear Island in Virginia. A little later, under Newsweek's aegis and at its urging, we made another startup, a monthly sports magazine called Inside Sports. This was spearheaded by Peter DeRoe and the business side of Newsweek. Again, we conceived it poorly, tested it poorly, and ran it poorly, despite a clever editor, John Walsh. It, too, lost larger amounts of money than we expected and drained talent, energy, and time from Newsweek itself. Important changes were taking place at the Star, which in the short run created some worry at the Post and in the longer run caused us even more concern before the end came, when the Star finally folded. Joe Albritton had worked hard to turn around his staid and failing newspaper. When he first came to town, he had put in as editor Jim Bellows, a great talent who didn't try to compete with us where we were strong, but went under, around, and beside us. The paper became livelier, more interesting, and scrappier. Jim started a gossip column called The Ear, which specialized in tweaking the Post, which the Star referred to as the OP, or the other paper. The most intimate details of the lives of many of us at the Post became grist for the mill of The Ear. In particular, it was savage about Ben Bradley and Sally Quinn, referring to them as the fun couple and reporting on their every activity, no doubt with some help from reliable sources in our own city room. We all came in for attention, some of it accurate, some of it half-accurate, some entirely fictitious. But despite the good things that were happening, the Star was in a real decline, which of course had started long before Albritton entered the picture. There is no question that its long-time dominance and success had bred self-satisfaction and lack of drive. It never seemed to occur to the ownership that the world could change. Even so, the extended Star family wasn't the main reason why we started to gain and the Star started to decline. A societal change in the country strengthened morning newspapers, while at the same time bringing hard times to the traditionally strong afternoon and evening papers. Principally, the growth of television network news, the flight to the suburbs from the inner cities, and urban problems affecting late-day home deliveries all weakened afternoon dailies. Possibly most important of all was the economy. As prices rose, particularly for labor and newsprint, newspapers raised rates, forcing advertisers to choose between papers, not divide their advertising as many had previously done. If a newspaper rose to a certain dominance, there was often a snowball effect. Advertisers realized that more people could be reached through the larger newspaper, so in an effort to cut costs, they eliminated the weaker one. Once the momentum got going, there was not much that could be done. In some ways, this is what happened to the Star, exacerbated by the lack of attention to the competition. For far too long, no one at the Star had taken the Post seriously. But our advantage was not yet overwhelming, and I had learned, as had my father and Phil before me, what it feels like to be fighting for your life. We knew how far we'd go for a line of advertising or a new subscriber. Don and I still bear the scars. Young as he was, Don too understood that nothing stands still, that success can bring with it the roots of its own downfall. In March 1977, Albritton reached an agreement to trade or sell his Washington, D.C. radio station, which, according to the Star's monthly publication for its employees, would provide Star Communications with a guaranteed cash flow over the next 20 years. Indeed, only a month later, Albritton announced the first profitable quarter at the Star since several years before he took over. I wrote congratulating him, and he responded that he knew one swallow didn't make a spring, but that at last he saw light at the end of the tunnel, which he also realized might be a mirage. The Star was a much improved product, and Albritton's brilliant moves in selling his radio and smaller television stations put him in a far stronger financial position. I was worried, but not as much as when, in early February 1978, Time, Inc. announced that it was buying the Star. Albritton was keeping the valuable television station. Now we were faced with the powerful, rich, professional, savvy Time, Inc., which we saw as an even greater threat than the Texas millionaire. Time's people tried new ideas, invested vast sums, and used Time magazine's foreign correspondents to run foreign news in the Star. And they spent even more money than Albritton had on promotion. The theme, Today's News Today, began to appear on billboards everywhere. On radio and television, the message about the new Star was delivered by tough-talking, private ears, Sam and Janet Evening, radio characters who snooped around Washington, dredging up scoops, all to the tune of Some Enchanted Evening. The Christian Science Monitor ran an article about the increased competition between the Post and the Star, headed Star Wars Come to Washington. One of the first things the new editor of the Star did under the Time Inc. regime was to exhume a 5-part profile of me by Lynn Rosalini that initially had been suggested by Joe Altbritton himself as a kind of hands-off look at me. In the end, he had ordered it killed because he thought it was so negative. Time Inc.'s people at the Star resurrected it, promoting it to the skies, and even running the first 2 parts of the series on the front page. I'm not exactly objective about the series, and have never reread it, but my memory is vivid that I was portrayed as a sort of Jekyll Hyde. Not that some of what Rosalini said wasn't true, but I was pictured so negatively that I feared no one would ever work for us again. I got a lot of sympathetic mail, and the Star ran a highly supportive letter from Barry Goldwater, which I found all the more moving for his not being close to me. Goldwater wrote, "Now, I don't happen to be one the Washington Post has been kind to during my political life. In fact, I imagine I have suffered as much from its editorial and reportorial whims as any person in politics. But that's beside the point. There comes a time, in my opinion, when decency in reporting must have some consideration, and neither your reporter nor your publication showed any inclination toward that. You can be critical in a decent way of the manner in which Mrs. Graham conducts her business, but I don't believe you have any right to be critical of the way she has conducted her life, nor have you the right to be dishonest about it." With Time Inc.'s arrival in town, it's a wonder that I had the time or inclination for anything else in my life, but several activities that were a mix of public and private provided me with both a reprieve from business concerns and a measure of fun and personal satisfaction. Bob McNamara, then president of the World Bank, had committed that institution to trying to help the nations of the so-called Third World. Northern countries were distressed by the radical rhetoric of the countries of the South and their irrational demands for billions of dollars in aid, and the countries of the South were angered at what they viewed as the insensitivity and heartlessness of the North. Bob's idea was to ask a group to look at these problems as individuals rather than as representatives of their countries, and he had tapped Willy Brandt, former Chancellor of West Germany, to lead it. The group came to be known as the Brandt Commission. Bob argued that it would be good for me to join, because it would expose me to an aspect of the world about which I knew little, because I would bring a sense of what was politically viable within the United States, and because it would be good for the Post and Newsweek to become more aware of these issues. Although I was reluctant to break our rule about not getting involved in organizations that took stands on issues, I decided there were times for exceptions to rules, and this was one. I accepted. 16 persons were appointed to the commission, 4 of whom were former or current heads of government. Ted Heath from Great Britain, Pierre Mendes France from France, Olof Palme from Sweden, and Chile's Eduardo Frei. 9 of the 16 representatives were from the developing countries. 2 of us, Peter Peterson, my old friend from the Nixon administration, and I, were from the United States. It was perfectly clear that I was a token woman from the North, counterbalanced later by the addition of a Malaysian businesswoman, Khatija Ahmad. The first of our meetings took place in December of 1977 at Gymnich Castle near Bonn. For me, it was like plunging into another world, one where people spoke peculiar languages, in all of which they tossed around strange acronyms while bantering about meetings and reports from the past, United Nations subdivisions, and the functions of the bank and the IMF. Since we sat alphabetically, it was only natural that several twosomes developed. My friendship with Ted Heath, my G to his H, grew over the 2 years of our seat assignments. For most of that first meeting, indeed for most of the first year, I said little or nothing, too intimidated by the unfamiliar issues and the experts around me. Gradually, through the meals, the walks, the informal gatherings over tea or drinks, the atmosphere began to change, and in certain areas, things were warming up a little faster than I realized. One of the most radical of the Third Worlders, a famous ladies' man, surprised me by inviting me to his room. I thanked him for the compliment, but said I followed an old adage, "Never where you work." He replied that he heeded another one, never say never. The atmosphere had certainly grown more friendly. As the time for the final meeting drew near, none of us could see how we were possibly going to produce a report. The commission seemed to consist of prima donnas who rarely agreed on anything, but our chairman was clearly determined to push through a report at the final meeting. During an exasperating afternoon session, Brandt, beet red and breathing heavily, blew his top, made a final statement, and withdrew completely, depressed at our lack of progress. The remaining commissioners decided that Shridath Sunny Romphel of Guyana from the south and Ted Heath from the north should work with Michael Hoffman, Brandt's aide, on the final draft. We met one more time, and led by Ted, worked our way through comments on all the sections. By great good luck, Ted later recalled, Brandt was delayed in arriving in England, and Ted seized the moment to force decisions and get the report accepted. What effect did it have? Quite a lot in certain European countries, very little, if any, in the United States. We had arrived at a negotiated consensus. There were things in the report to which all of us took exception, but you had to sign it or not, and we all did. In the end, the report turned out to be exactly what it was designed not to be, with the various commissioners basically representing their states or constituencies. I spoke to Ben about the report before it was released, saying that, though I knew this kind of thing didn't much interest him, I thought it mattered, and hoped he would make sure it got the kind of news play it deserved. Ben's attention span was not always perfect, but I was positively disbelieving when I located the story of the commission's report on page 25 of the Post. Even the New York Times had put it on page 3. I was so angry I was absolutely unable to speak to Ben for 24 hours, lest I explode. He had simply forgotten. I suppose I did contribute something by imploring the editors of Newsweek to focus on the issues, in fact urging them to do a cover story on the Third World. I knew it wouldn't be a thriller, but thought it was something we owed our readers. After considerable foot-dragging, Newsweek finally did a cover story, sometime shortly after the Brandt report was issued. To the not-so-secret satisfaction of the editors, it was the worst-selling issue of the year. During this period, while I was still publisher of the paper, more of my energy was going to the Washington Post Company than to the Washington Post itself. I had been thinking for quite a while about turning the paper over to Don, but was struggling with several questions. When was the transition best for Don? When was it best for me? When was it best for the Post? Toward the end of 1978, when I had been publisher in title for nearly 10 years, and in essence for some years before that, I decided the time was ripe. I was enough detached as a parent to know that Don was ready. He has always been more mature than his years, always hard-working, conscientious, decent, bright, and able. And I needed to concentrate on the chairman and chief executive officer aspects of the company, which were growing more and more demanding. At the same time, I had come to the conclusion that there had to be a change in the editorial page. I couldn't solve Phil Jalen's problems for him, and the situation had grown difficult for everyone. I thought that Phil should retire, and that Meg should become editor, and I knew Don agreed, but for two reasons I didn't want to be the one to make the change. First, Meg was my friend, and I worried that such a move on my part, in essence promoting my friend, might be perceived negatively. More important, I had learned when I began to work and made my own first major move, bringing Ben to the Post, that there was a completely different relationship with the people you put in place as contrasted with the people you inherited from your predecessor. I didn't want Don to inherit my editor, even if it was someone on whom we agreed. I felt strongly that he ought to have the opportunity to name his own editor. So I decided to act at the beginning of the following year. On January 10, 1979, at a routine expanded staff meeting, I turned over the title of publisher of the Post to Don. Having made my announcement, I went on to answer publicly some of the questions I had been wrestling with privately. What would it mean, and why now? To the question of why now, the answer in fact is easy. It is because Don is ready and I am ready. Actually, I suspect Don was ready before I was, I told the staff. Don, with his usual grace, responded, My mother has given me everything but an easy act to follow. My father, Phil, my son, and I all had in common a love of the newspaper business. But Don is also very different from the other three of us. To begin with, he was far more qualified in experience and temperament than we were at the time each of us took over. He had edited both the St. Albans News and the Harvard Crimson. Newspapering clearly was where his interests lay. When he was in Vietnam, we had written each other about his future on the Post. By then, he had decided to put off coming to the paper in order to learn more about the world. He strongly believed that you couldn't be a good newspaper man if you've done nothing but work for newspapers all your life. Besides Phil, others whom he respected had suggested to him that doing many different things and having many different experiences was the best possible preparation for any job. Don had particularly learned from John Gardner and from Scotty Reston, who told him that he thought, The important thing was that no one should be able to say to someone, You just don't understand my situation. He wrote me in December 1967, Instinctively, I see that once I start working for the Post, I won't ever work for anyone else again, and there is a hell of a lot I want to do before then. Don began, after Vietnam, by becoming a policeman in the District of Columbia. The Post's much-loved longtime reporter on the police beat, Al Lewis, came to see me when he heard the news, saying, I can stop this. It's way too dangerous. We don't want him running around doing that. In some ways, I didn't want it either. It was dangerous, and it worried me. But I also knew that it was what Don wanted, and that he had good reasons for choosing to do it. Oddly, he seemed to grow up noticeably more in the time he spent in the police department than in the previous 2 years in the army. I asked him why that was so, and he responded, Oh, that's easy. In the army, you just do as you're told all day long, while on the police force, you're constantly having to make your own decisions in difficult circumstances on the spot. Don started at the Post as a metro reporter, beginning in January 1971. He then moved through various jobs in a number of departments, from being a general clerk in accounting to assistant home delivery manager in circulation, from promotion clerk to outside sales representative in classified and retail advertising, from assistant production manager to Newsweek's Los Angeles Bureau. In the fall of 1974, Ben Bradley had a problem with the sports department. Two managers were battling with each other, and the section clearly was feeling the effects. Without telling me, Ben resolved the problem by offering the job of sports editor to Don. I had counted on furthering Don's training program by getting him more involved on the business side of the company, and was somewhat irritated with Ben for resolving his problem at my expense. But I also saw it as a great mid-career management job for Don. Because it combined his passion for the editorial side of the business with his love of sports, I could hardly frustrate him by not agreeing. So I acceded to the move on condition that Don go in and out in a year and that he replace himself, which he did brilliantly, with George Solomon. In his year at the helm of sports, Don worked harder than anyone I'd ever seen. I once found him at his desk at 3 in the morning and asked him why he was there. His response was that since he'd done a stint in production, he knew exactly how many late scores it was possible to send down to the composing room between 2 and 3 a.m. and still get the paper out on time. When his year in sports was up, Don became assistant general manager, and it was from that vantage point that he was so helpful to me and so instrumental to the paper during the pressman's strike. I knew then that he was more than ready to take over as publisher. The relationship between him and me might have been immensely difficult, but we have both worked to make it smooth. It's difficult to have a parent for your boss. To have that parent be your mother is even harder. Don deserves the major share of the credit for making our professional relationship a happy one. Once he was publisher, Don named Meg to succeed Phil Jalen as the editorial page editor, with all the expectable stresses and strains. She reinvigorated the page, and ever since has edited it and the op-ed page, and written her column for The Post and Newsweek with great distinction. Though I had always known Don would one day become publisher, what I hadn't foreseen is that it would be so hard for me to give it up. But the move was an enormous emotional wrench, which I had to steel myself to endure because I knew it was right. Publisher of The Post is a title I would miss. I loved being directly involved with the paper and was intensely emotionally attached to it. The early years of participation with my father and Phil in the struggle to survive, and my own dramatic years as publisher, had left me with an immeasurable and immutable love for The Post. But I wasn't going to hang on too long just because I enjoyed it all so much. So I had withdrawal pangs. But I left with a more than full-time and challenging job as head of the company, chairman and chief executive officer, responsible for the growth, soundness, and economic health of a half-billion-dollar company with 5,000 employees and about 2,000 shareholders. By the fall of 1979, the company was doing pretty well from a financial point of view. There had been a slight run-up in the stock, but as always, there were problems, including the ongoing difficulties at the Trenton Times and Inside Sports, and an earnings decline. I was feeling less than confident about my ability to turn any of this around. Warren and I were driving down to Glen Welby for the weekend when, as tactfully and gently as he could, he broke the news to me that Bill Ruane and Sandy Gottesman, close friends of his and investors who had bought a lot of Post stock for themselves and for their clients, were going to sell tens of millions of dollars worth of it. Ruane managed the Sequoia Fund, and Gottesman was a managing partner at the First Manhattan Company, and these groups were about to sell all or half of their Post stock. Warren had pondered how best to deliver this news, and he tried sugarcoating it in every way he could. I have to admit that my immediate response was to burst into tears. Here were these terribly clever investors, reputed to have such great judgment, who no longer believed in us. Others surely would be leaving in droves. I considered their move a referendum on my management of the company, and it was clear I was found wanting. Warren did his desperate best to console me, explaining that Bill considered he had done so well on Post stock that it added up to too much of some of his portfolios. He was keeping his own stock. "You don't know Wall Street," Warren tried to reassure me. "People don't think in a long-term way there. When your stock reaches $100, Wall Street will buy it." Naturally, I thought he was just trying to make me feel better. It was absurd to think that the stock would ever reach $100. I was not consoled. Warren, of course, had a totally different perspective from mine on what Bill and Sandy were doing. He viewed it as an enormous plus in the lifetime of the company, almost like the Times-Herald merger. Though he knew I'd be profoundly distressed by the idea, he realized right away how much the company would benefit in future profits by their selling their stock. He tried to convince me that we should be holding a party, adding, "Don't worry, we'll just buy what they sell. It will be good for us and they'll regret it." Although I didn't stop worrying, we did buy in the stock at an average price of $21.91, which Sandy and Bill had bought before two splits at an equivalent price of $6.50. Once, much later, Warren and I discussed women bursting into tears in business situations, and I reminded him of our ride to Glen Welby. "Well," he said, smiling, "we made several hundred million dollars then. The next time you burst into tears, call me first." He added, "Look at it this way, Kay. If you hadn't bought it in, I would have burst into tears, so one of us had to cry." From this point on, I really concentrated on trying to get the company straightened out. I resigned from most of the outside boards on which I had been serving, the University of Chicago and George Washington University among them, as well as Allied Chemical, and became much more actively involved with groups associated with the media and with newspapers, the Bureau of Advertising, the Board of the Associated Press, and most important, the Board of the American Newspaper Publishers Association. Given all the company's problems with which I was dealing at the time, it may have been crazy to have been involved so actively with all three of these industry organizations, but since none of them had any other women, it served a purpose for them and was helpful with the industry, as well as helping me become more familiar with some of the larger problems that media companies face. The Bureau of Advertising, on which I served from 1971 through 1979, bumping up to its executive board from 1980 to 1982, had not been a favorite of Phil's, but I found it a congenial place. Its board had a decidedly lopsided composition at the time. Not only was it all male and all white, but it was business, not editorial-oriented. The 18 directors on the AP board are elected by the membership, and anyone wishing to serve has to campaign for election, which I found difficult. Although I'd been warned that most people didn't get elected on their first try, I was still disappointed when I was defeated on mine. The following year, in April 1974, I was better organized and won, becoming the first woman member of the board, on which I served the allotted three terms until 1983. I had been elected to ANPA's board in 1973, again the first woman, but this time not until a man who actively opposed women members had himself left the board. I wrote Lori Wilson, Al Newhart's wife, "The view of the good old boys will not die except generationally. Their view of the lovely ladies and toasts to the wives will be with us for the rest of our ANPA lives." In those years, the chairmanship of the board alternated each two-year term between men associated with big and small papers, and under a very undemocratic procedure, the incumbent chairman essentially chose or designated his successor. In 1979, Al Newhart, who was the group's chairman at the time, approached me with the idea that I become chairman after the tenure of a nice, able man, Len Small, who ran a group of Illinois papers and was slated to succeed Al. The idea had never entered my head, but Al was firm in his conviction that I should be willing to take on the job, pointing out that if I didn't, there was no other woman in the foreseeable future who would be there to do it. Little by little, I came to agree that I should be available, another barrier to crack, and that it might be interesting as well. I said if he could pull it off, I'd like it. So Len invited me to succeed him when his term was up in 1981 and made it known that this was to happen. But another tragedy hurled me into yet another job with little or no preparation. Len was killed in an automobile accident, and with almost no warm-up, I was handed a new time-consuming responsibility nearly 2 years before I expected it, becoming chairman of ANPA in April of 1980. Managing a big, all-male, except for me, diverse organization, small and big papers have very different points of view and interests, was one more stressful obligation. It was inconceivably intimidating for me, at first, to preside over the two-day committee meetings and the conventions, and in between to deal with the staff at the headquarters in Reston, Virginia. In addition, I had to wrestle with the dawning problems of electronic news and the challenge of the phone companies. Around the company, I was dealing with matters ranging from the circulation outlook at the Post and Newsweek, to newsprint costs, to continuing profit problems at PNS. I tried to concentrate on strategic planning for the company and hoped to make progress in the divisions and to improve the way in which each related to the others. We still needed a sounder growth policy in corporate. I had been thinking and working and picking the brains of various people for years about growth issues, but had seen little or no progress. I was also thinking about the importance of performance appraisals and rewards, financial and otherwise. As always, there were people problems. In the early summer of 1979, I went through another painful turnover at Newsweek. Ed Koestner had been a very successful number two under Oz Elliott, but without Oz, he was having difficulty managing the large staff. Ed was a journalist of rare gifts, but not yet a manager. Morale was at a low point. One person described to me what was happening as being like the magazine having a nervous breakdown. Peter DeRoe and I spent a lot of time discussing what to do, and again, I'm afraid I listened to him and took his advice against my instincts. For one thing, I told Peter that if Ed was in so much trouble, we had to warn him. Peter's answer was, "Absolutely not. If you do that, he's so unpredictable he might walk right out the door." Stupidly, I gave in to Peter's fears and didn't have the blunt talk with Ed that anyone under danger of dismissal has every right to expect and that can often be effective. In the meantime, I'd been approached by an editor whom I knew at first hand to be highly skilled in newspapers and whose skills I thought would be transferable to a newsweekly. This was someone I had worked with and trusted, who wanted the job, and who I thought would be perfect. But when I discussed it with Peter, he discouraged me from taking a risk by bringing in a non-newsweekly editor. Again, I acceded to what I believed was his better judgment. So we went back to Lester Bernstein, once Newsweek's national and managing editor, who we thought would make a safe transition for a few years until we found another editor. I knew instantly that this was a wrong move when the first thing Lester did was take a month's vacation. When Peter and I broke the news to Ed, he was naturally upset and bitter, and he had a valid cause for complaint since neither of us had ever fully aired our differences with him. There was a meeting to let the editorial staff know about the changes. Ed walked in, said, "I am leaving the magazine," and then walked out of the room and out of the building. I stood up directly afterwards, said I was sorry for the abruptness of it, and praised Ed and Lester. Then I, too, left. I wanted nothing more than to escape, and there was such a large crowd waiting for an elevator that I walked down the stairs from the 40th floor to the 12th, where the corporate offices were. It was another change of editors at the top, and yet another chance for people to skewer me for being a difficult woman. I have noticed that when an editor got changed, it was often the people under him who had complained the most vocally who then criticized me the loudest for the way it was done, so sudden, so unexpected, so cruel. Privately, however, people told me it was a move that had to be made at the time to help Newsweek. We went through two more unsuccessful tries at the editorship before we finally came up with Rick Smith. There were more changes to come. My relationship with Mark Mayer was not an easy one, and was growing more and more trying as I realized that here was yet another executive who had not worked out as I had hoped. Mark was a good person with great abilities in certain areas, but he was probably too young and inexperienced to have been rushed to the top of the company as president and chief operating officer. In July 1980, we announced that Mark would resign at the end of the year. The decision had been all the more difficult because I was fond of him personally. This may have been the low point of my business life. It was certainly one of the most painful and discouraging times I'd had. Mark's departure got writ large in my mind, not just as my personal failing, but rather as a sign that the whole company was in turmoil. Corporate was certainly not well run. We hadn't grown in any sensible or substantive way, and Newsweek was in managerial confusion. This time, the press really beat up on me, even exaggerating the number of changes among the top executives, in part because of a misreading of our organization chart and a mixing up of the company with the paper. There was no one within the company to whom I could turn as a new president. I was going to have to look outside. Unfortunately, I was so shaken and discouraged by the personnel mistakes we'd made that I feared we wouldn't search for a replacement in the right way. My reputation as a difficult person to work with made a search hard under the best of circumstances, and stories were circulating that no one but Don could become president, because who would want to be sandwiched between a mother and a son? But Don was still very young and had just taken over the post as publisher the year before. Just as I began to look for help, Peter DeRoe, who by now had become a director of the company, and chairman of Newsweek as well as president, after Bob Campbell's retirement, suggested that we bring in a consulting firm to study the company and be an administrative help while I was trying to run it alone. I thought there was merit to the idea, so we hired McKinsey & Company, and for the next year, there were repeated meetings between people from McKinsey and from our company, going endlessly over what we'd done and what we hoped to do. I was increasingly baffled about the whole consultation process, which seemed to be little more than McKinsey's regurgitating what we had told them in a slightly different but not very helpful way. The most imprudent suggestion made by McKinsey in its report was that we should stop buying in the stock. It had been all right to do at $20 and $21, but now that the stock had reached $26, it was no longer a good idea. I actually took this advice for a while, although, as Warren has repeatedly said, anyone would have told me the company was probably worth more than $400 million on the market and that the stock market value was about a quarter of that amount. Perhaps no one at McKinsey ever stopped to do that math. Afterwards, Don referred to the page in McKinsey's report on which the suggestion had been made as the half-billion-dollar page, given that that's what it probably cost us in lost value to the company. At the same time, I worked with a headhunter in my quest for a new company president. There were numerous meetings with the headhunter and with various candidates, none of whom seemed very plausible, and many of whom seemed remote from what I had in mind. They were either condescending to me or obsequious, and neither alternative appealed to me in any way. This activity went on for nearly a year, with me essentially running the company alone, with help from Marty Cohen, our financial vice president and treasurer, and a management group that included the division heads and a few other corporate officers. It was a rough year, and I had no reason to think it was going to get any better until I resolved the management problems. In November 1980, an additional worry came when Mobil Oil Company President William Tavalarius sued the Post for libel for a story we'd run a year earlier by reporter Patrick Tyler detailing some of his business dealings. This lawsuit dragged on in various courts. One jury awarded the plaintiffs compensatory and punitive damages of $2.05 million in 1982, a decision overturned by a judge, then reinstated. Finally, the U.S. Court of Appeals ruled on March 13, 1987, that the 1979 story was substantially true and was not libelous. And after more than 7 years, the case came to a close with a decision in our favor. By the time of the lawsuit, the cumulative effect of the pressures and anxiety and activities on so many levels at once took its toll. On a visit to New York in March of 1981 to make a speech to an advertising group, I contracted pneumonia, spent 12 days in the hospital there, and returned home extremely weak. Immediately on my return, I got a call from Jim Shepley, president of Time Inc. and chairman of the Star, asking to meet me. This signaled yet another dramatic moment in our lives, mine and Don's at least. Jim's call meant that Time Inc. was ready to do something about the Star and wanted to talk about the possibility of a joint operating agreement. Our family had always wanted and welcomed the competition, and felt that everyone was better off with it than without it, so Don and I and Warren had many meetings with our lawyers and the Star's representatives trying to arrive at an agreement. We were still negotiating when, 10 days after our last meeting, officials from Time Inc. held a press conference to announce the closing of the Star in 2 weeks. I actually heard the news on the radio while I was in my car on my way to work. The announcement left me with a range of emotions. First and foremost, I was deeply sad that it had come to this, that Washington was to lose a fine paper that had many loyal readers, not to mention employees, who would be devastated. I was also numbed by the reality of this final victory of sorts, bittersweet though it was, after all the years of struggle. This was not a competitor we hated, but one we respected. There was some talk of possible buyers for the Star, but that seemed unlikely. Rupert Murdoch, Walter Annenberg, Mortimer Zuckerman, and Armand Hammer were all mentioned as considering making proposals. To prevent anyone from merely buying the paper in order to profit from selling its assets, Time put some fairly rigorous requirements on any buyer. We at the Post continued to talk to people at the Star and to others, Al Newharth and Armand Hammer among them, about possible alternative joint operating agreements. But in the end, there seemed no way to save the Star. On August 7, 1981, the 128-year-old Star ceased publication. There was no gloating. As Don said, this was a sad day for Washington and the newspaper business. The city and the country had lost a great American newspaper. A Post editorial a few days later stated, "Nobody wanted the Star to go out, but it is gone. Sadness, nostalgia, anger, sentimentality, and apprehension have all been stirred by its loss, and these feelings have been shared by the people at the Post." I knew the Star's folding would present problems as well as opportunities for us, including resentment of our dominance and of the loss of the other much-beloved voice. There was predictable bitterness. Unless one understands newspaper economics and the inevitability of what happens when some degree of dominance is achieved, the tendency is to blame the remaining paper for being ruthless. Almost a month later, when it was clear that no one would come forward to revive the fallen Star, we bought its land, building, and presses. We hired a number of its writers, most notably Mary McGrory. We picked up enough of its circulation so that, even with our new Springfield plant, we desperately needed the building and presses, and we're still printing there. Not a year passed before the opening of the Washington Times newspaper, founded and funded by the Unification Church. Its circulation and advertising are weak, but the paper does provide a lively, conservative editorial voice, at vast expense to the church. Presumably, its backers feel that their presence in the nation's capital and access to the government are worth the price. The beginning of the end of the Star was not the only dramatic occurrence that spring of 1981. The previous fall, an article by one of our new, young, 26, bright reporters, Janet Cook, had appeared on the front page of the Post. Jimmy's World, a piece about an 8-year-old heroin addict, created a major impact on the community. The story was sent out on the news service wire and became a national and even an international cause célèbre. We felt the story was so good and so well written that we submitted it for a Pulitzer Prize, which it won. The day after the prize was announced, though, the whole story began to unravel as it was revealed that there were inconsistencies and exaggerations, if not untruths, in the way Cook had portrayed her own life. When the biographies of the Pulitzer winners appeared in various newspapers, Vassar College called us to say that Cook had not only not graduated from there with honors, but had not graduated at all. She had attended, but left after a year, for the University of Toledo, where she had received a bachelor's degree, not a master's, as she'd claimed. People on the Toledo Blade called the Associated Press to say that their records of Cook's credentials didn't jibe with those that were appearing in wire stories. When we checked what Cook had listed as her own credentials, we found that they didn't correspond to what she'd written elsewhere. For instance, it turned out that she didn't speak several languages. On April 15, 1981, Janet Cook finally confessed to Post editors that she had fabricated the story. Jimmy turned out to be a composite, and the quotes attributed to the child were, in fact, invented. Certain events Cook had described as having eyewitnessed never happened. Ben sent a telegram to a long list of news organizations saying, "It is with great sadness and regret that I inform you that Janet Cook, the Washington Post reporter awarded the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing Monday, has determined that she cannot accept the award. She regrets these events as much as the Washington Post regrets them. She has offered her resignation, and it has been accepted." We immediately assigned our ombudsman, Bill Green, to write about what happened and why, believing that this was the most objective way to hang out every detail of our embarrassment and to help us all understand where we'd gone wrong. Many things had indeed gone wrong. At almost no point was Cook asked hard questions about what she was reporting. She was trusted, and she wrote so well that no one thought to check the facts of the story. The editors all relied on each other, so that the story had gone from desk to desk until it eventually ended up on the front page. Even her bio had not been sufficiently checked when she was hired. I believe that we did all the right things after the fact. We revealed the truth in excruciating and embarrassing detail. We apologized editorially. We examined the system that had let it happen. Bill Green asked some tough questions, including whether race, she was black, helped Cook advance faster than she should have, and drew a number of conclusions. The business of trusting reporters had gone too far. Young reporters were looking for a Watergate under every rock. The scramble for journalistic prizes was poisonous. New reporters shouldn't be pushed so fast. The editors didn't listen enough to lurking doubts below them. Janet Cook blamed the paper for putting too much pressure on reporters to get what Woodward called the holy shit story instead of solid reporting. She accused us of creating competition among reporters to get on the front page. The journalism faculty at Howard University filed a complaint against the Post relating to the Cook affair. The New Republic titled one of its articles on the matter, "Deep Throat's Children." I felt for Don Graham, who was then the publisher and who took on a very tough news conference and handled it well. I stuck out our collective neck even farther by calling Tom Winship, then chairman of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, a group that was meeting in Washington shortly after the prize was returned, to ask him if he was planning a session on the affair. He said he wasn't, and that at this late date, there was no place for it. My response was, "You'll be the laughingstock of the industry if you don't do the program. I personally dread it, but it's the big ethical issue of the moment. You'd better find the time." Tom agreed and scheduled an early bird meeting, heavily attended, in which our editors got pummeled. I was proud that Don Graham stood there by Ben, often with his arm around Ben's shoulder. Also right there was our incomparable former editor, Russ Wiggins, who, with his usual wry humor, said, "I feel great about the state of the American press. Every editor I saw assured me this couldn't have happened at his paper." We took a terrible drubbing from all sides, and rightly so in some ways. Clearly, we had made mistakes, and some of our procedures were not functioning properly. But I felt that the self-righteousness on the part of many in the industry, assuming it couldn't have happened in other places, was not only spiteful, but short-sighted. I later told an ANPA gathering that there was a real danger that, in our efforts not to have such a thing happen again, we will become so nervous we will go to the other extreme and not do the job that a free press is supposed to do. To add to my anxieties during this difficult period, Peter DeRoe told me he'd found another job, ironically back at CBS. He was quite willing to start in again on what was wrong with me and the company, but by this time I'd grown tougher and told him that once was enough. It seemed to irritate him not to be able to do a repeat monologue on my failings. Only as the search for a new company president grew a little more organized did I become more optimistic about the future. I held interview after interview with various candidates, at first not quite knowing what it was I was looking for, but somehow feeling I'd know it when I saw it. The search went on for so long that I began referring to it as the search for Mr. Wonderful. But over the course of the process, I came to realize that I did have an idea of the goals of the company, and the search process helped me crystallize that idea while at the same time helping me define the qualities I was looking for in a president. At last, in early July 1981, when I interviewed Dick Simmons, who had been president of Dun & Bradstreet, I instantly saw in him a number of the qualities I knew I needed and wanted, including a proven track record as a manager. A few days later, Warren, Don, and Mary Graham and I had dinner with Dick at my house. He and I then met together for several hours on a Saturday, talking comfortably. 2 weeks later, I extended an offer to Dick to become president and chief operating officer of the Washington Post Company. The search for Mr. Wonderful, which had taken more than a year, had ended. Chapter 28. Dick Simmons's arrival helped make the decade of the 1980s the best years from a business point of view, both for the company and for me. The Washington Post Company began achieving its goals of sustaining earnings growth, developing new businesses, and building for the future. And a great weight was lifted from my shoulders. I no longer dreaded the meetings to discuss plans, options, acquisitions. Without the tension that had existed for so long between me and whoever occupied that office across the conference room from mine, the future seemed more certain and more positive. I realized only in retrospect how tough the previous years had been. Working became a pleasure again. Without recognizing it, I had gotten to the point where, the better things were going under my management, the more unhappy I became that the results weren't even better. Many of Dick's first moves helped make those results better yet, and equally important, he helped me gain some perspective on how the company was doing, what we should be doing, and what we could expect to do. In some ways, Dick and I were an unusual duo. We are very different from each other in style and temperament, yet were remarkably compatible. In time, we almost shared the company's top two jobs. He was much more than a chief operating officer. He was my partner and friend. His true and sure sense of himself helped keep him untroubled by my peculiar managerial background and my tendency to call Warren about any problem or opportunity. I tried always to give Dick the credit he deserved, as well as to give him a free rein in all operating aspects of the company. He, in turn, seemed very unbothered by my higher profile. Dick moved fast and with assurance. In late October 1981, just a few weeks into his tenure, we announced that we were selling the Trenton Times to Al Britton Communications, and a few days later, we announced that we were engaged in discussions relating to the sale of Inside Sports, which had lost a lot of money and showed few signs of turnaround or possible improvement. I knew it had to be sold, and was relieved when Dick moved quickly to do it. The sales of these two properties significantly reduced the company's earnings for that year, but allowed us to focus our efforts on the development of our core businesses, which were all setting new records for revenue. Dick also took the lead in looking for growth opportunities in line with the main mission of our company related to the way people communicate. In 1982, we took our first step into the electronic age by getting into the cellular telephone business. A few years later, after building some of the first cellular systems in the United States, we divested ourselves of what we had acquired in this area. It was a strategic exit based on our own recognition that those companies with market dominance had a significant advantage over the smaller players, of whom we were certainly one. Nevertheless, we did very well financially. Alan Spoon, who later became president of the company, deserves much of the credit here. In 1983, we acquired a small electronic information company called Legislate, a database publisher that is now the nation's leading provider of online information on federal legislative and regulatory activity. We also got into cable programming, specifically related to sports, by acquiring about 50% of Sports Channel Associates, a network that telecast leading professional sports events to New York area cable subscribers. These businesses, too, were later sold. In November 1983, we successfully launched a national weekly edition of the Washington Post, an idea I had heard discussed since almost the first years of my father's ownership of the paper. This edition now has a circulation of well over 100,000. Because the Post is a local paper, geared to the Washington metropolitan area market, it was never feasible for us to undertake a truly national daily edition, but this weekly tabloid of selected Post articles on politics and government satisfies many people's desire to follow the Post's political reporting. Late in 1984, We acquired a tutoring and test preparation company, the Stanley H. Kaplan Company, now called the Kaplan Educational Centers, which interested Dick more than it did me. I confess that my lack of interest was reflected in my saying to Dick, "I don't give a shit about it, but if you think it will be profitable, let's do it." Not only has it worked out well for us, despite some ups and downs, but it has considerably more purpose and potential than I realized. In 1985, we purchased 20% of the common stock of Cowles Media Company, owners of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and some other smaller properties. That interest has grown over the years, and we now hold 28%. We were less successful in several other areas. Early in 1982, we tried to buy the Des Moines Register, a paper and a company I respected greatly and would have loved to acquire, but we weren't the highest bidder. Just after we launched the Weekly, we bought a 20% interest in the National Journal, a magazine about the federal government. But after being involved for 3 years, we let Times Mirror acquire it. We looked hard at the number two paper both in Chicago, the Sun-Times, and in Houston, the Post, but didn't go any further. As a company, we have been conservative in our growth, perhaps too conservative. But as the 80s ended, we were not left with a load of debt and the resulting need to sell the good properties, as were many other companies, who let their desire for growth overwhelm their judgment. We turned down the Denver Post, which was bought by the Times Mirror Company with disastrous results. Sometimes the things you don't do are as important as the things you do. My major frustration in the first few years after Dick's arrival was that we were still not regarded by the financial world as a hot property, which kept our stock undervalued. This, however, worked to our advantage, since we continued our consistent pattern of buying in the stock, which helped us later. Of all our attempts to grow, our most spectacular success and the best acquisition that Dick and I made together was cable, which began with our purchase of 53 cable systems from Capital Cities Communications Company, a purchase finalized in January 1986. Throughout 1985, Warren had helped his friend Tom Murphy, CEO of Cap Cities, acquire the ABC network. I was happy for both of them when the deal went through, at least until I realized the implications for me vis-a-vis Warren, who pointed out the obvious, that he would be going on the board of Cap Cities ABC and would therefore have to get off ours. By then, Warren had been a board member for 11 years and never missed a meeting. Telling me this was hard for him. He knew I would feel bereft, to say the least, but he assured me he would still be at the other end of the telephone, that we would see each other as much as usual, that he would not vanish from my life. Even so, I was disturbed and saddened by the news. In fact, it worked out well. Warren kept his shares in our company and remained involved with us. More important, as a sort of consolation prize, Murphy allowed us to bid on Cap City's cable systems, whereas that company divested everything else through investment bankers. Warren kept a correct distance from the negotiations, which were carried on between the Post Company and Cap Cities exclusively. We ran numbers, deliberated, discussed at length, argued among ourselves, and finally completed the acquisition for $350 million, much the biggest acquisition in the company's history, and the one that propelled us forward to our highest rank in the Fortune 500, that of 263, in both 1986 and 1987. By adding new customers and purchasing other small systems, Post Newsweek Cable has now grown from 350,000 to 580,000 subscribers. And happily, Warren is now back on our board, after serving Cap Cities ABC for 10 years when it was sold to Disney. At Newsweek, after years of tough going, we had begun to turn things around. One of the most painful failures on my part was that both the business and the editorial sides of the magazine kept undergoing managerial turmoil, each for different reasons. With editorial, I was directly responsible for the problem, and it took a long time to get it right. I still sensed great pools of ill will and even disloyalty at Newsweek. Part of this may have been due to the excessive management turnover, but some of it certainly was the result of the natural competition between those working for the company in Washington and those working in New York. I finally offered Rick Smith the editorship, and knew he'd be just right for the job when he responded with, "Don't worry, I won't fuck it up." Indeed, he didn't. Under his strong leadership, first as editor and later as president, the whole mood improved, yet another example for me of how things get better when management acts together. Even with the problems news magazines have experienced in the new environment, Newsweek has had many fine successes and a great deal of solid growth. In the mid-1990s, Newsweek came to be considered the best of the news magazines, with its stellar writers like John Alter, Bob Samuelson, Jane Bryant Quinn, Alan Sloan, George Will, Meg, and many more. I felt a great deal of satisfaction. Post-Newsweek stations began to do better and better as well. Our stations cover all three major networks, so that, as Warren once pointed out, anything achieved is independent of whether any one network happens to be hot at the moment. Joel Chaseman proved that he could operate the television stations so well under Dick's direction that their margins grew competitive with the best in the business. Our television news was as distinguished as that of the Post and Newsweek. All of the stations, including the two we have since acquired in Texas, KPRC in Houston and KSAT in San Antonio, now ably led by Bill Ryan, were and continue to be leaders in news. Following the demise of the Star, the Post's penetration of its market was around 50% daily and 70% Sunday through most of the 1980s, by far the highest of any major U.S. metropolitan daily. Out of everything we accomplished during the 80s, I was proudest of our improved management of the company, an area in which Dick was particularly strong. I once said I would like to win a Pulitzer Prize for management, and finally I was able to believe that we were becoming a truly well-run company. What's more, the effects of better management began to show. Our core businesses improved immeasurably in profitability, so that after a few years the company really took off. For several years, the Washington Post Company led all companies in our field in a number of ways. Probably more important to me than any public acknowledgement of our gains, however, was what Warren thought about how we were doing. In mid-1984, he sent Don, Dick, and me a memo saying that he had just gone through a recent survey of publishing companies that charted their performance in various areas. He pointed out that when Berkshire Hathaway bought its first shares in the Washington Post Company in the spring of 1973, the cost was $10.6 million, and the market value in 1984 for those shares was $140 million. He had gone down the list of publishing companies in the survey and run the numbers to calculate what would have happened if he had spent the same $10.6 million at the same moment in the shares of the other companies listed. In any other company, he would have fallen far short of what he had earned with Post Company stock, so he concluded, "Instead of thanks a million, make it thanks anywhere from 65 to 110 million. It got even better later. After all the years of struggle, things had finally started to go smoothly for the company and for me. Though I never stopped worrying altogether, it's not in my nature. The business of the company was going well enough, and I had enough confidence in Dick that I began to relax a little and to enjoy a larger life again. As the editorial corporate head of the company, I had always felt strongly that part of my job was to follow important world issues that could affect the company and its holdings, but I hadn't always been in a position to give this responsibility the time and attention I felt it deserved. Starting in the late 1970s, I had taken some trips with a few editors and reporters, Meg and Jim Hoagland almost always going along, to one or several countries to observe for ourselves what we had been reading about in the pages of our own publications. The number of these trips picked up in the early 1980s, largely because Dick's steady hand would be at the helm while I was gone. On one of the first of these trips, at the request of the Romanians, we interviewed their communist dictator, Nicolae Ceausescu, in the very palace where he and his wife were later killed. He spent the entire interview complaining of his treatment by the West, while we tried to ask questions about his persecution of different religious and ethnic groups and his repression of dissent. The interview was stilted, to say the least. We took turns asking predetermined questions, which he answered at length and mechanically. His long answers were shortened by our interpreter to, "He says, welcome." In 1978, the high point of a